It's the MPR News Update for Thursday, May 8. Good day. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up on the podcast, the grocery business continues to evolve in the Twin Cities. Metro Transit discusses a snooper. Amtrak is back in downtown St. Paul. Bicyclists beware in some Minneapolis intersections. And sex education isn't the same as it was when you and I were kids. First, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office filed murder charges yesterday against a New Brighton man accused of killing a neighbor who provided food for deer. Brant Williams reports.
According to the charges, earlier this week, 57-year-old Neil Curtis Zumberge fired a 12-gauge shotgun at two neighbors, killing one and wounding the other. New Brighton police say they knew there was an ongoing dispute between Zumberge and the two who lived across the street. According to the complaint, part of the feud involved charges that members of Zumberge's family blamed his contraction of Lyme disease on the presence of deer in the neighborhood. And police say Zumberge's son threatened to burn down the neighbor's house because they were feeding the deer. Zumberge is also accused of attempted murder. Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, in a statement, called the incident tragic and senseless. And he says the investigation is ongoing. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota House has passed a bill designed to improve working conditions for women. Tom Scheck has more.
The bill, known as the Women's Economic Security Act, aims to convince employers to pay men and women in similar jobs equally. It requires businesses to make accommodations for pregnant and nursing women and lets employees, men or women, take 12 weeks of unpaid pregnancy and parenting leave. DFL Representative Carly Moline of Hibbing says the goal is for all businesses to provide accommodations for new parents.
There are some that do it and some that don't, and this is, you know, really just trying to address that all women, no matter where they work, should have those sort of protections.
The bill also requires state contractors to certify that they pay men and women in the same job categories equally. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is raising concerns over that portion of the legislation. They say the reporting requirements are confusing and could increase litigation costs for businesses. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minneapolis Charter Commission is making its third attempt to raise the cost of running for public office. Here's Curtis Gilbert.
The proposal would raise the filing fee to run for mayor to $250. Charter Commission Chair Barry Clegg says the current $20 fee resulted in a staggering 35 candidates for the office on last year's ballot.
I think we need a higher filing fee to make sure that the candidates that are on the ballot are viable candidates.
Captain Jack Sparrow was one of the less viable candidates. He received fewer than 400 votes. Still, he says raising the fees is undemocratic.
Maybe you all have plenty of money. You can afford $250. I can't afford it. A lot of people that are serious candidates can't afford it either.
Candidates who can't pay the fee can gather 500 signatures instead. Raising the fee will take a unanimous vote of the full city council. Similar proposals failed twice last year, but backers say this time they have the support they need. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Milwaukee-based Roundy's, one of the biggest players in the Twin Cities grocery business, is leaving the market. The owner of Rainbow Grocery Stores is selling 18 Twin Cities locations to Super Value, Lund Food Holdings, and other local buyers. 9 other Rainbow stores are still up for sale and will close if no buyers emerge. Martin Moylan reports.
In a press release, Roundy's CEO Robert Mariano said the economic downturn over the last few years and increased competition in the Twin Cities made it difficult for Roundy's to keep Rainbow competitive. So Roundy's is shedding the Rainbow stores in the Twin Cities and will focus on developing its Wisconsin and Chicago stores. Grocery industry consultant David Livingston says he's worked with various parties that have shown interest in the Rainbow locations. He says the chain stores have been on the block for about 7 years.
This has been in the plans for quite a long time. We knew that Rainbow would have to be split up among numerous retailers. It couldn't be sold as a chain because that would be too difficult, you know, being the number three player in a big unionized market. So the best thing for them to do was to sell to local operators and have it split up.
Livingston said Rainbow has been losing ground fast in the Twin Cities.
Cub is still the market share leader. Rainbow has historically been number two, but I think they've now been bypassed by Target, and now Walmart is moving up the ladder.
The rainbow sale is just the next big change in an industry that has been churning nationwide. In the grocery business lately, the growth has been among two groups: higher-priced players like Whole Foods, Lunds, Byerly's, and others that focus on service and quality, and big players such as Target, Walmart, and Costco that emphasize low prices. That leaves middle-market grocers such as Rainbow and Cub in a difficult position. Sandra Scrofan is research director for Planet Retail, a research and consulting firm.
Across the U.S. retail sector, things are moving upstream to the more premium, higher end, or very focused on value at the lower end. So middle is not a good place to be.
The trick for Cub is to find a middle way to thrive. But analysts say this deal will make that easier to do. Jennifer Bartashis is a Bloomberg industry analyst who follows the grocery business. She says this is a good deal for Cub.
Cub Foods is a market leader in the Twin Cities area, and they're there for a reason. People enjoy the stores, they have good customer service, and the larger the chain, the more that they can then leverage their size in order to be able to offer, you know, better deals to customers, stay oriented on customer service and things like that.
10 of the 18 Rainbow stores being sold will operate under the Cub banner. Overall, there'll be 66 Cub stores in the Twin Cities after the deal closes. Cub has been eyeing the Rainbow store locations in Chaska, Eagan, Minneapolis, Lakeville, St. Paul, Oakdale, Plymouth, Roseville, and St. Louis Park. Jeff Swanson is a spokesman for Cub Foods and its parent company, Super Value.
We're always looking for the right opportunity at the right time, and these stores are in important communities. They serve an important need to customers.
Lund Food Holdings is picking up 3 Rainbow locations and will rename 2 of them. Aaron Sorensen is a spokesman for the grocery chain.
When the purchase is completed this summer, the Rainbow stores in Woodbury and Eden Prairie will become Byerly stores, and the Rainbow in Plymouth will remain a Rainbow.
After the transaction closes, Lund Holdings will operate 27 stores in the Twin Cities, including a downtown St. Paul location that opens this month. Wisconsin-based Roundy's will get about $65 million in cash from the sale, plus the proceeds from inventory that will be sold at the closing of the transaction. Roundy's expects the deal will close by the end of September.
Marty Moylan on the NPR News Update. Metro Transit says about 1,300 people had their driver's records improperly searched by a veteran employee. An investigation by the regional transit agency found that one of its former supervisors snooped on ex-girlfriends, fellow transit employees, media and sports personalities. Laura Ewan has more.
Earlier this year, Metro Transit performed an audit of all of its employees who have access to the state's driver and vehicle services records. It discovered just one instance of abuse. Richard Johnson, who monitored bus operations from the Transit Control Center in Minneapolis, performed more than 7,000 unauthorized searches, according to Metro Transit documents. The 22-year veteran of the agency told transit officials he did it out of boredom and innocent curiosity. Metro Transit police are coordinating with other law enforcement agencies to consider possible criminal charges against Johnson. Allegations that yet another government employee abused his access to personal data elicited a here-we-go-again response from Chuck Samuelson. He's executive director of the ACLU of Minnesota.
I've lost count how many times this has happened.
Samuelson says even if Johnson didn't mean to harm anyone, his actions harmed everyone because it erodes the public trust. He says every time one of these cases pops up in the news, the public is left to wonder just how far the scope is.
Well, there's 5 of these that we've heard about. There must be way more. And maybe there's more, but not way more. Or maybe there aren't any more. And we don't know because it's all being done in secret. So we start distrusting law enforcement. We distrust building inspectors, all sorts of government entities.
The Metro Transit case has come to light at a time when state lawmakers are working on bills aimed at preventing data breaches by government employees. Don Gemberling oversaw government data privacy issues for the state from 1973 to 2004 and has offered his expertise to legislators.
Part of what they're hearing is a lot of testimony from state and local government that everybody's working real hard to fix this. And there is some evidence that there has been less, but clearly this latest incident and some other things I've heard about illustrate that the problem continues.
One recent case involved a Department of Natural Resources employee who was accused of inappropriately looking up driver's license records about 19,000 times. Among other things, the records include photos, addresses, height and weight. Gemberling says he's clued into a pattern.
How much of this breach stuff is focused on people looking up women, okay? And frankly, the prettier, the better. You know, and it's like, wait a minute.
In the Metro Transit case, the investigation into Richard Johnson fails to mention whether he was targeting either sex. Besides public figures and former girlfriends and their spouses, Johnson looked up records of relatives and fellow transit employees. He told agency officials the snooping didn't affect his job and took place during idle time from 2011 to 2013. Metro Transit spokesman John Sigvalin says agency officials jumped on the case as soon as the revelations from the audit came to light in February.
We had moved to take corrective action, to discipline the employee and move towards termination. And this is something that we have trained employees on many times and retrained, and so we do take this very seriously.
In March, Metro Transit had recommended Johnson be fired. Johnson appealed the decision and resigned late last month before the appeal process concluded. Metro Transit documents show that Johnson and other control center staff were trained on proper access of the driver and vehicle database. John Sigvalin points to a memo Johnson signed, acknowledging he understood the rules.
It was very clear what is and what is not proper in the role of a supervisor in terms of accessing DVS information.
Sigvalin says Metro Transit will continue its audits and has restricted the number of supervisors who have access to the database. The police investigation is determining whether to notify the 1,000-plus individuals whose personal information was breached. But it's unclear what the latest breach means for future lawsuits. In February, a federal judge in Minneapolis dismissed three cases involving wrongful snooping of Minnesota driver's license data, saying the information isn't private.
Laura Ewan there for us. Well, after 43 years, passenger trains again are pulling into Union Depot in St. Paul. Last night, Amtrak's Empire Builder arrived from Chicago before continuing on to the West Coast. The station reopened to the public a year and a half ago following a major restoration. The return of passenger rail to downtown St. Paul is being heralded as a major civic event. But as Matt Sepik reports, Amtrak faces some major challenges in the upper Midwest.
At a ribbon-cutting ceremony, St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman talked about what his immigrant grandmother saw when she got off the train in the heart of the city's bustling downtown in the 1920s.
She had the first impression of a new land that was a home for her for the rest of her life. But it was an impression of a city that had a ton of things going on.
While downtown St. Paul has much more going on than it did a few decades ago, Amtrak passengers arriving on the Empire Builder late at night won't see the same bustling rail platforms Coleman's grandmother did 90 years ago. But last night, they got something close. Dozens of railroad buffs lined up on the platform to wait for the train. For Eric Wood of St. Paul, the event brought back personal memories. Wood's father worked as a waiter, steward, and later an inspector for what became the Burlington Northern Railroad. In the late 1960s, the company's final years in the passenger business, Wood also worked for the railroad in the summers during college.
I was a train porter. At that time, they called them porters. Now they're attendants. But I help people on and off and a trip between here and Seattle. It was wonderful. Wonderful experience for me.
Now boarding Amtrak Train 7 and 27, the westbound Empire Builder.
The first passenger train to arrive at Union Depot since 1971 was more than an hour behind schedule. While the Empire Builder's arrival was an occasion for nostalgia and reminiscing, its tardiness highlighted the present-day problems on the route. The booming oil business in North Dakota means the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad is running more and more tank car trains on the rails it owns and shares with Amtrak. With newly extended timetables, the trip from Chicago to either Portland or Seattle is scheduled to take 49 hours. Gary Israelson, Amtrak Superintendent of Operations for the Central Region, admits it often takes longer.
We've been between about 52 to 53 hours. It's been pretty routinely of late. We've had some days we got in only an hour or two late. It just kind of varies here and there on how to handle us.
While all the oil trains have been a persistent headache for Amtrak, Israelson says BNSF is spending $400 million to upgrade its tracks in North Dakota, which could eventually help reduce delays. But that'll mean westbound Empire Builder passengers will have to take a bus from Fargo to Minot through the end of September. For train passengers who aren't in a hurry, the delays are expected and not a big deal. Nancy Anderson flew to Chicago with a friend yesterday morning just so they could be among the first to ride to Union Depot.
It was fun to be on the train and so relaxing to just glide along and look at the countryside and just not have to worry about driving, not the headache of flying, just get on the train and go.
Anderson then walked into a palatial station that underwent a $243 million restoration in 2011 and 2012. While passenger trains only pass through St. Paul twice a day, Amtrak says it's studying the possibility of adding a second run from Chicago. Meanwhile, the historic station is becoming a transit hub downtown. Megabus, Jefferson Lines, and Greyhound all use Union Depot as a terminal for intercity buses. And on June 14th, the Green Line Light Rail will begin running on the street out front.
Matt Sepik on the NPR News Update. Bicycling season, if there is such a thing, is fully underway with the warmer weather. And it turns out some traffic intersections in the Twin Cities are more dangerous than others for bikers. CARE 11 NPR News reporter Tricia Volpe crunched the bike crash numbers from Minneapolis, and she talked with Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition.
What does the data show?
Well, pretty interesting data analysis here. We combined crash numbers from the city of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota and found approximately 1,400 bicycle crashes from 2009 to 2013. Now, these crashes varied. We're talking about bike versus car, bike alone, sometimes a pedestrian was involved. And the severity of each crash also varied. Seven people were killed in bicycle crashes during that time period, but most other crashes resulted in no significant damage. Now, we did try to identify the most dangerous intersections based on those crash numbers, and the top five are as follows: Cedar and Minnehaha, Lake and Franklin, Franklin and Lindale, Hennepin at 1st and 2nd, Hennepin and Lindale at Groveland.
I know Hennepin and Lindale at Groveland is pretty busy, but is there something else about those other intersections?
Well, the intersections do have a few things in common. They are all high traffic areas, as those of us who travel those areas know. A lot of cars, bikes, pedestrians, and sometimes the intersections were confusing because several roads converge. Take Hennepin and Groveland, for example. I counted five different busy roads coming together in one place over the Lowry Hill Tunnel. And all of those intersections also have some kind of bikeway, some accommodation for bicyclists. But both drivers and bicyclists were sometimes confused about how the bikeways worked, like who had the right of way, for example.
Well, bike-car crash is never a good thing. What are some of the reasons for those crashes?
Now, looking at those 1,400 crashes over 5 years, the biggest contributing factor was a failure on somebody's part, either the driver or the bicyclist, to yield the right of way. Inattentive or distracted driving, no surprise here, or disregarding a traffic signal were the other top reasons for crashes. Now, the city of Minneapolis recently did its own in-depth study of bicycle crashes and found that the most crashes between bicyclists and drivers happened where the bicyclist was not riding in a predictable way, like running a red light, for example, and where drivers didn't see bicyclists.
So you went out with a bike commuter to see what it's like on the roads. So what did you find out?
Yana Flissran, she was our lucky participant. She's an experienced bicycle commuter. Every day she bikes from her home on DuPont Avenue to work, which is much closer to downtown Minneapolis. We're talking at least a couple of miles, sometimes five or six, depending on what path she decides to take. And she has had a few close calls over the years. We really wanted to get a sense of the road from her perspective. So with a CARE 11 photojournalist, we equipped her bicycle with several cameras and asked Yana to bike some of those hotspot intersections. Very interesting. indeed to see the ride from that perspective. At busy Hennepin and Franklin, for example, Yana and the cameras noted how fast-moving cars quickly squeezed in around her.
There were cars that wanted to make a right that were behind me, and I wasn't sure if they saw me. There were cars that wanted to go straight and didn't want to wait for me to have an opening to make a left.
That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, can you imagine being in that spot?
No.
Pretty tough.
So, what is Minneapolis doing to try to make it safer for bicyclists?
Well, a lot, actually, hence the city's bike-friendly reputation. In fact, over 5 years, crash numbers year to year stayed relatively steady. And during that same time period, according to the Minneapolis Bicycle Coalition, the number of people bicycling has gone up more than 70%. Also, in 3 years, the city has implemented at least half of its 400-mile Bikeway Master Plan, and for the last 2 years, has been using cameras to study the effects of different road configurations and traffic signals on bike-car interactions. And the folks at the Bicycle Coalition say the easy projects, though, are mostly done now, and it is time to make some bigger changes to the more complicated intersections. There does seem to be a move toward that as well. At least three of the five hotspot intersections we identified are slated for a major overhaul in the next 2 years.
Interesting stuff. Trish, thanks.
Thank you.
Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition and the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Michael Olson is an online editor at nprnews.org here at Minnesota Public Radio, and we like to check in with Michael every now and then to see what's going on digitally. And Michael, what do you have for us today?
Well, looking here at Minnesota Today, our aggregation site of important news from around the state, from other news organizations, WDIO reports, and they're up in the Duluth area, that the first salty of the year arrived in the harbor there, but it got stuck in the ice. So this is the winter that just won't let go.
Yeah, they had all that snow, and then, of course, Lake Superior has been frozen over. They had hail yesterday, so now I guess the big ships are getting stuck in the ice in the Duluth Harbor.
Yeah, and it's a concern for with the fishing opener coming up this weekend. It's a concern for other tourism-based folks and the anglers themselves. But we see a hopeful note here from an outfitter, Spirit of the Wilderness outfitter up in the BWCA area, saying that conditions are changing quickly. Rains, warmth, and wind could give fishermen much more open water by the weekend. So, you know, they're seeing some open water up there, but clearly, as we're seeing from in Duluth, the ice is hanging on.
And speaking of ice, I hear there's a nice palace that may be going up as part of a bid to attract a big football game.
Yeah, you know, the Super Bowl bid, where a handful of Minnesota businesses that got together to pool, you know, do you know how many million? It was like 40.
$30 to $40 million, I think, they had to have pledged,
right,
to be able to show the NFL that they could indeed pay for the Super Bowl if they brought it to our fair state.
Right. So as part of the bid, they all gathered together is and part of the now there's a rumor out there that's being floated that St. Paul may, for the first time since 1992, build an ice palace, so that would be another tourism draw for that winter, you know, because the Super Bowl takes place in February
usually. Yeah.
So that would be prime ice palace time. Certainly would seal the deal for me. I loved the ice palace in 92. It's such a cool experience going through there, and thought that it was a pretty neat thing as a kid.
Well, as a Missourian and I guess a fairly recent transplant to Minnesota, I've never been to an ice palace. So, yeah, I'd probably go check that out if they had one.
Come for the Super Bowl,
stay for the ice palace. All right, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Michael Olson is an online editor at nprnews.org. Do you remember when you learned at school about the birds and the bees? Sex education is part of the curriculum in every Minnesota high school. Reports from Hennepin County show teen birth rates there have actually declined faster than elsewhere in Minnesota, even nationwide. Some of the credit goes to the people on the front lines. Dan Olson visits two schools to learn how Hennepin County's pregnancy prevention program works.
The curriculum of the Teen Outreach Program, or TOP, includes frank discussion of the biology of reproduction. But at every weekly session, facilitator Munira Muhammad starts with questions about what's new in the lives of the Robbinsdale Cooper High School students in her class. She wants to know, for example, if there are any signs of behavior that will affect their future.
I see them really not connecting to their school. I see them not connecting with their classmates. I see them being lost in the shuffle of what is high school, what is being a teenager.
The outreach program is offered to schools, teachers, and students willing to participate. Proponents say the program has contributed to a drop in teen pregnancy rates. Hennepin County's teen birth rate is down 40% since 2007. Federal health researchers say the recession, access to contraception, even reality TV programs that show the consequences of getting pregnant are all part of the reason. Others credit abstinence education, a key component in Minnesota schools. Even so, the United States still has one of the highest teen birth rates among wealthy countries. Munira Muhammad says many of her students don't talk with their parents about pregnancy prevention or relationships. Friends, the internet, and popular culture play a bigger role.
They know exactly when I ask them those questions, they know. They're like, no, it's not good to be influenced that easily. It's just, okay, then what? That conversation then starts going. So at least it's a start.
Cross the line if you believe in love at first sight.
Facilitator Kate Fay asks students at MERC, Minneapolis Employment Readiness Curriculum, an alternative high school, about their first crush. Health teacher Becky Clark volunteers to go first. When she was in school, she decided to simply tell a boy she had a crush on him.
And of course, what did he do?
He didn't like you
back. No, he ran in the other direction. I think there was physical running in the other direction.
TOP, the Teen Outreach Program, is in 32 schools in Hennepin County and will reach 2,200 students this year. Kate Fay says talk about love, romance, and crushes in her sessions is okay when it would be deemed inappropriate in other classes.
That's not the time or place. Well, when is it? And in TOP, we have the luxury of being flexible. So if our conversation takes us elsewhere where the students need to talk about something, we do it.
Then here's bread and peanut butter.
Standing in here?
Yeah.
Besides classroom discussions about relationships and human sexuality, Hennepin County's pregnancy prevention program includes service learning. Robbinsdale Cooper High School students help serve breakfast at a downtown Minneapolis homeless shelter for their project. Munira Muhammad says too many young people live in a bubble. Service learning through the TOP program shows them there's a bigger world out there.
I feel like TOP comes in and I try to make sure that they get out of that bubble and really figure out what's around them and who needs help and who are you and how you can fit in this world.
That's Munira Muhammad. She, along with Kate Fay, are facilitators for Hennepin County's Teen Outreach Program. They spoke with our Dan Olson on the NPR News Update. And I'm Phil Picardi. See you back here for all of the Friday news.